Welcome to ICOSA's Driving Force Radio, where we discover what drives today's leaders. Now, here's your host, Jan Mazzotti.
Good morning, and welcome to Driving Force Radio, where we seek to discover each and every week what drives today's leaders. On today's show, my co-host will be Kelly De La Torre, and we'll be doing a fantastic show on our Energy 101 segment. Happy New Year, Kelly.
Happy New Year to you too, Jan.
You know, as always, you know, we talk about so many interesting things during Energy 101, and today we are talking about, again, energy security, but from a very different perspective today.
That is what I love about this show, is that we approach this same question about energy security and domestic energy supply from so many different angles, and we get to highlight these emerging technologies that are really making a difference.
Yep, and our guest today is the president and CEO of Independent Energy Partners, and this is really an interesting business with interesting technologies, Kelly.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to Al about, they've developed a new way to further extract our, not only our domestic oil reserves, but it has many, many, many other applications that I'll let Al talk about since he's more versed.
Absolutely. As Kelly said, our guest is Alan Forbes, the president and CEO of Independent Energy Partners. He's launched and grown more than a dozen energy-related ventures during his 25-year tenure in the energy industry. And he really has, his expertise spans so many different areas, including advanced power generation systems, internet security technologies, energy industry portals, and monitoring and control systems. Welcome to the show, Al.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Al, you know, we were talking before the show, and I was focused on our domestic oil reserves, but you pointed out that these have so many more applications. Could you sort of talk about the framework for this technology and where it applies?
Sure. The geothermic fuel cell, which is the technology that we've patented and are developing, is primarily targeted at unconventional hydrocarbons. And that category includes things like oil shale, tar sands, several other categories of heavier oils, such as the type they produce in South America. And also, in addition to unconventional hydrocarbons, it's also applicable to unconventional oil production, which includes things like recovering stranded oil from these abandoned oil fields where much of the oil that was originally discovered is left in place. So we have unconventional hydrocarbons on the one hand and unconventional hydrocarbon production on the other, and this geothermic fuel cell has applications across that whole range.
So Al, based on something you just said, you know, you have these abandoned oil fields. Why is so much oil left behind in this traditional extraction process that we know goes on?
Actually, there's a couple of reasons. The biggest being that the pressures that existed in the oil reservoirs when they were originally discovered and put into production has subsided over time, and the decreased pressure in the formation has forced the barrels per day in these wells to drop below a quantity that's economically feasible. The other aspect of it is a little bit combined with the pressure point. A lot of oil in traditional wells is thicker. It's pressure required to move that heavier, thicker oil to production wells is another factor. So you wind up with secondary oil recovery in these abandoned wells involving techniques like steam injection, very prominent in California, for example, down in the Kern County area, where they burn natural gas, produce steam, inject the steam down into those old formations. The heat improves the viscosity, and the pressure that the steam is under as it's pushed into the ground repressurizes the formation, so then you start reproducing these old wells that have been shut in. Hmm. So that's just one aspect of secondary oil recovery.
So, and so is that how the idea for use of these geothermic fuel cells came about, is that it's the same?
No, actually, it's a related application. The interesting point that'll be clear in just a moment when I talk about the geothermic fuel cell is that the strength of economics associated with unconventional oil recovery or unconventional hydrocarbon production really lies in a key economic consideration, and that is the cost of energy to heat the ground. And there is kind of the beginning of the story for the geothermic fuel cell. And it occurs really with an interest in oil shale, of which here in this Colorado and immediately surrounding area, we've got a couple of trillion barrels of known resource. And more specifically, work that Shell Oil Company was doing on the Western Slope, where they had taken an old technology that was developed back in the 40s, refined it based on material sciences and some technology advances, but it basically involved utilizing electrical resistance heaters that were basically cables that were dropped down into boreholes in the oil shale formations, pushed electricity into those cables. It's kind of like the heater element inside a toaster, where that the filaments turn red hot.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Similar aspect happens with this Shell process. The technical term is in situ conversion process. That's what they've patented. In our case, it's geothermic fuel cell. So here's basically how the GFC distinguishes itself in that cost of energy to heat the ground, and looking at that application that Shell's been. I would say over the last 10, 15 years, they've probably spent a couple hundred million dollars trying to refine this in situ conversion process specific to oil shale production. In our case, one of the other principals in my company, Marshall Savage, who's credited as the inventor, pretty technically astute guy, had some unique insight into what Shell was doing and also some interest in fuel cell technology. And realized or recognized that one particular type of fuel cell technology, solid oxide fuel cell in particular, operated at a very high temperature, almost the exact temperature Shell was trying to achieve with these resistance heaters, and uniquely among the categories of fuel cells, operates on multiple fuels. So you a fuel cell is like a battery. As long as you continue putting fuel into it, it produces electricity. And in the case of solid oxide fuel cells, it produces not only electricity, but a very high temperature waste heat.
Wow.
And so the concept that was patented, and it's what we've developed, involves packaging solid oxide fuel cell technology as a downhole heater. And after a very brief startup period, and in particular oil shale, which is a very gassy process, a portion of the gases that are produced along with the oil are fed back into the fuel cell system to keep them running.
Okay,
the high operating temperature is the thermal input that actually recovers the oil. And since we're using fuel cells kind of in the opposite of what most people think, I always make it a point to comment that as a byproduct, we produce large amounts of baseload green electrical energy. Hmm. So unlike Shell, that either has to purchase or produce this 7x24 electrical input to make these cables red hot. In our case, we use the waste heat from this fuel cell process as the thermal input, and we produce electricity as a byproduct. So the economics are, as a result, very strong.
Sure.
It's an electrochemical process. There's no combustion, so there's very little environmental impact in terms of emissions. It's in situ, so there's no mining and all of that tailing and things that people associate with resource production of this type. And as I said, as a byproduct, fuel cell electrical output qualifies as green energy like solar and wind. But unlike the intermittent nature of those two resources, when we go online and stay online, 7x24, we're producing energy just like you would get from Xcel, from a coal-fired power plant.
So, Al, talk about that a little bit, about the emissions. You mentioned it a minute ago. What kind of emissions are there when you're doing this kind of work, and especially as it compares to primary extraction methods?
Well, the one of the unique things about fuel cell technology, it's talked about in the media regularly, is part of the future hydrogen economy. In the case of fuel cells, as you input fuel, and in our case, it'll be natural gas. you produce electricity, and there's an exhaust stream that is mostly water vapor and a small component of carbon dioxide, which is easily separated and can be used for a variety of applications, such as enhanced oil recovery or some of the commercial markets that utilize CO2. So from an emission standpoint, and the term that is used routinely in the business, carbon footprint, we have a very, very small carbon footprint, just minimal.
So can you sort of frame up for the listener what it looks like when you go out to a well site? So how are these abandoned well sites, and then what's your approach with these fuel cells? How would that look?
Well, the actual hardware involves a circular tube. Inside there are packaged applications of this solid oxide fuel cell technology. We are actually excited that I've recently entered into agreement with Delphi Corporation, who are producing prototypes and testing them as we speak. Those will be shipped here into Colorado this month, and we've engaged Colorado School of Mines, okay, who will actually be locally doing the final prototype pre-field testing, and then actually will be in the field in 2014 and actually making oil in a field demonstration project in 2015, wow, just to give you an idea of the timeline.
Yeah.
But in terms of what you see, these tubular configurations, they will be produced in either 15 or 30-foot lengths. They will be coupled up just as you would see oil field piping, dropped into a drill hole, the upper portion of which will be cased just as you would see a typical traditional oil well, so there are no groundwater issues. You'd see a wellhead, and the matrix of these heater wells would have at specific spacing collection wells or production wells. So what happens is, in oil shale in particular, and it's not dissimilar in conventional fields with stranded oil, is that the hydrocarbon in oil shales, referred to as kerogen, which is basically an immature oil, another 50 million years, and it would be liquid, like they're producing up in Bakken and the Dakotas and the Marcellus formations. So with the application of heat, specifically around 350 degrees centigrade, kerogen starts breaking down, and the oil, the energy component, actually pyrolyzes and becomes a vapor. And that vapor actually is what moves to these production wells, comes up the pipe, a portion of it, well, all of the oil component condenses out. About two-thirds of the energy is recovered in a very high-quality oil, and the about one-third is non-condensable gas, very similar to natural gas. That's what's recycled back into the fuel cell system to keep it running.
Keep it going.
Yeah.
If you could recover the unrecovered oil left in place, what do you anticipate the impact to the U.S. would be?
Well, the most significant part of answering that question in my mind is not so much becoming totally energy independent, because I think there's some geopolitical business issues,
right,
and politics,
yeah,
involved there, but the idea is to improve the energy security and the economic security as well, the United States, by being able to produce its indigenous resources, domestic,
yeah,
resources, with the end result being reducing its reliance on imported oils. And so the impact is several fold. One, by being able to produce unconventional hydrocarbons of the quantities that we have here in this country, the immediate benefits become, of course, jobs,
yeah,
all the oil field, the services, the manufacturing production, but ultimately a lower price at the pump, lower energy costs. And then the bigger picture, macro kind of impact, is that it improves the overall energy security and, by at the same point, the economic security for the United States.
So. Right. And it also allows us to sort of, it seems like it would allow us to sort of pick and choose what countries we want to deal with in our oil consumption, because if there is a particularly volatile country, at least we'll have the leeway of saying, you know what, we're going to further extract our domestic reserves instead of deal with, say, Venezuela.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think the points I always enjoy talking about with the geothermic fuel cell is that it actually addresses the couple of key technical and economic considerations that have kept a lot of our domestic resources being produced, and sort of by de facto all of the renewable energy stuff that gets talked about day in and day out, wind, solar, bio and diesel fuels. By being able to produce these oil shale oils, heavy oils like tar sands, in an environmentally sensitive way, and at low cost, really is a pretty much a game changer.
It is. It is. And that's what I wanted to ask you about, is talk about some of those game-changing things that could happen with this, because it seems like this is sort of a completely different way of handling this, but it's going to require some infrastructure investment, it sounds like, to be able to really get it to where it's a usable, functional technology. Can you address that to a certain extent?
I can. The infrastructure aspect of being able to deploy this geothermic fuel cell is not dissimilar to any other oil or gas production requirement. I mean, there's pipelines, pumping stations, what's referred to in the business as balance of plant, where oil, water, gases are separated before they enter the pipelines. I think the challenge, the kind of the age-old what keeps me awake at night kind of question that I had a concern with really had to do with the strong demand that we're seeing, interests around the world, China, Canada, South America, sure. Europe, Africa, and our investors have asked, you know, with all of this interest, when you guys go commercial, how in the world are you going to ramp up,
yeah.
be able to manufacture
right.
these geothermic fuel cell components? And so I mentioned earlier Delphi Corporation. We had some work done by the Department of Energy to redesign the original work that was done by Pacific Northwest National Labs to design a prototype around our patents. We had that modified early last year that allowed us to interview and potentially work with existing industry that had already commercialized solid oxide fuel cell technology, and it would accelerate our time to the field by working with an industry partner rather than continuing to work with the Department of Energy and sure. Pacific Northwest National Labs specifically in sort of a greenfield grassroots approach. At the end of that redesign effort earlier last year and the opportunity to interview a number of interested companies that were looking for a big market for their fuel cells, Delphi prevailed. And you know, Delphi is an international company.
Yeah, awesome.
Has a long, long history in ceramics, has developed a solid oxide fuel cell division, and a bunch of great guys, a huge ramp-up capability. And beyond their 30 or 40 major manufacturing facilities that are located around the globe, part of what we had them agree to, or part of the deal, is that they are just referred to as our strategic global manufacturing partner. So in addition to their in-house capabilities, they're poised to engage with third-party contractors,
sure.
big manufacturing concerns that are that would gear up and add to their capacity to meet a large demand.
That's great.
So, and then it seems like that could be a massive expansion. Do we, in your opinion, do we have the skilled workforce to do that? Delphi has the skilled workforce to do that, or is there some other areas that maybe we should look at as far as education?
I think in terms of actual commercialization and deployment, of the geothermic fuel cell. I think from an education standpoint and existing workforce capability, we're in pretty good shape because it's a highly automated. It's one of the things Delphi brings is their industrial automotive high volume manufacturing capability. So I think the education process, in my view, really has more to do with opportunities like this with folks like ICOSA to raise our visibility and mm-hmm. educate people, particularly the folks on the environmental side
right.
who have kind of a standard position and pushback on emissions, water usage, just kind of the classic points that they stand
yeah.
on that we haven't purposely taken the opportunity to rebut or comment on up mm-hmm. until recently.
Sure. Sure. So when you talk about that and you talk about some of that environmental pushback that I think every energy organization, even clean energy, faces, what are those barriers to development both at the market level as well as the regulatory level for these cells?
With our initial development activities focused around this Rocky Mountain region, the Piance Basin here in Colorado, the northeastern area of Utah and southwestern Wyoming. I think that one of the regulatory issues that, again, I think is more of an education process, there's always a concern over water.
Mm-hmm.
And the traditional industry, earlier efforts in developing oil shale and some of the other mine-oriented resources used a lot of water.
Mm-hmm.
And western slope area, this is typically arid. So there's, I think, from a regulatory standpoint, there's going to be a close look at the impact of water utilized in our process. In our case, the bit of water that's required in the process, in the conditioning of fuel, is part of getting it ready to send back down as a fuel for the fuel cells. The bit of water required there is actually recovered from the exhaust stream from the fuel cell operation. So from a process standpoint, we're water neutral. So that's one of the things from a regulatory standpoint. I know we're going to have to address that. The other, and it's, it falls in the same category, is air emissions. People are going to say, what kind of air emissions are we talking about? And I think at the end of that discussion, we're going to be very favorably viewed, both from the water standpoint and the low carbon footprint with minimal emissions. But we're anticipating those things. I've built a lot of projects and gone through that whole permitting process, and I have a sense of the positions that people have, and it was some of the bigger reasons several years ago that got me excited about the geothermic fuel cell, because I realized that the various market forces that would eventually lead to a successful company included things like not just economics, but environmental sensitivities, water usage, air emissions, things like that.
How can listeners learn more about the organization? What's the website?
The website for the company is www.iepm.com.
That's www.iepm.com. Kelly, as always, this is a fascinating conversation. We have to run to break, but when we come back, we'll have more with Alan Forbes, the president and CEO of Independent Energy Partners, and we'll talk more about the work that they're doing with the new geothermic fuel cells. Kelly, I know you have a blog where people can learn a lot about the energy technologies we talk about here. Can you give listeners that information?
Yes, and I will post a summary of this conversation also on the Rocky Mountain Energy blog, which is rmenergyblog.blogspot.com.
Perfect. And if you want to learn more about any of the work that Kelly does, you can go there, or she is certainly one of our most prolific writers and bloggers here at the ICOSA organization. So you can go to theicosamagazine.com to learn more about so many of these fantastic energy things that we do. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Driving Force Radio, presented by ICOSA. Once again, here's your host, Jen Mazzotti.
Welcome back to Driving Force Radio. My co-host today is Kelly De La Torre, and we're doing a fantastic show on Energy 101. And our guest today is Alan Forbes, the president and CEO of Independent Energy Partners. And Kelly, we've been talking about this new technology, these geothermic fuel cells, which can go into retired oil fields and things like that, and really extract some of that leftover oil that's sitting in the ground, and it really becomes something that we can address through energy security, as well as there's so many climate things that are great and emission things that are great about this technology. And it's just a fascinating conversation.
It is a fascinating conversation, and what it points out is that and what it makes me think about actually is when they first were developing these oil fields, it's crazy to think that where we stand now with our technology to then, I mean, they were really brave, I'm thinking. And that's just what I was thinking during break. But before we went to break, we were talking about the regulatory issues and how they also impact the economic issues. We talked earlier about the economic benefit of using these fuel cells and that they make economic sense. Is there any reason why you would need to use incentives, or are there incentives available? We always talk about this on the show, as these things are subsidized in order to get to market, because it's difficult.
That's true. Because of the very high thermal efficiencies associated with this geothermic fuel cell process, which translates into strong economics, we don't need the kind of incentives that you hear about with, for example, wind energy tax credits, energy production tax credits. And some similar benefits are available to solar power. We do, however, because we qualify under EPA guidelines as green energy, green tech, and under some oil and gas industry regulations that have similar incentives, production tax credits, energy production credits, renewable energy credits. There's a whole basket of those things that are available to us that we'll utilize in the overall bottom line enhancements of our business that'll be most meaningful to investors and shareholders in our company. But from a basic project economic standpoint, we don't need them.
In light of the benefit that this would bring to the United States as far as our energy security and our ability to help control sort of our role in energy politics, global energy politics, by allowing us to select what countries we wanted to deal with and all of that, it seems important to get the consumer involved and knowledgeable about what's going on in the industry, because obviously the oil and gas industry hasn't always been viewed favorably by the consumer. And this is something that could be, it is really a benefit. It's a benefit to the environment. It's a benefit to our security. It's a benefit to our lifestyle, mm-hmm. like we always talk about. So how do you envision that rolling out across the country? And if there are listeners that would like to get more involved, how would they get engaged in helping you get this technology out there?
Well, I think you had commented earlier about educational needs. I mean, in my opinion, I think just taking the opportunity for interviews such as this one to raise our visibility, have people understand that this 21st century technology has been developed, the variety of things that have occurred most significantly in material sciences that have allowed the fuel cell industry and solid oxide fuel cells in particular to operate at the efficiencies and in the manner that they do. There's a lot of that stuff that's going on in the background, from places like NASA to Pacific Northwest National Labs, which is a very, very strong material science organization, and all the nanotechnology and carbon fiber things that are happening that, you know, people hear about in, you know, airplane wings and things that are lighter and stronger. This is a 21st century technology evolution. And I think for people to become supportive, they need to be more familiar with it. And so I think in addition to, like, the ICOSA organization, certainly our website, we've got a blog, a lot of information and background, a lot of frequently asked questions kinds of things that are available for people to review if they want to get a little more background on what we're doing.
I have to ask the question, because you talked about that the technology is in play right now and Colorado School of Mines is going to partner with you in 2014, and then it really goes commercial in 2015. My question is really around our allied partners, especially in this hemisphere. We know, you know, up in Canada, the oil sands and the tar sands, or tar sands, that's what we call them, the tar sands and the oil deposits that are north of us are massive in scale. Talk about the rollout on the commercial basis as you head into 2015, and what does that look like? Is it really focused here in the U.S. first and manufacture here, or is it really more of a global movement?
I think the answer to that question is both. Our initial beachhead business, the initial commercialization deployments, are programmed to happen here in Colorado for a variety of reasons. Our association with Colorado School of Mines, we have as part of our business activities acquired several billion barrels of mineral resources here in Colorado. But in addition to that, we have a number of parties in Canada, for starters, in the heavy oil tar sands arena that are pretty excited with the prospect of using our geothermic fuel cell in one of the two big applications that are used to recover or produce tar sands right now.
I'll bet.
One is the is the one people see mostly in the news up in Fort McMurray, with these huge open pit mines where they use these big clamshell drags and load up these huge trucks. And they process that oily sand, wind up with generally what's referred to as a synthetic crude.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that, by the way, for your listening audience that isn't aware of it, about a million plus barrels a day comes in about 2 miles north of your studio at these refineries just north of I-70.
Sure, sure.
Those are owned by Suncor out of Calgary, and a big part of their production is actually piped down to the Denver area. It's refined. They make gasoline, diesel, jet fuels, and most of that motor fuels is still marketed under Phillips, I think. The other technique that's used up there, the acronym for it's referred to as SAGD, S-A-G-D, steam-assisted gravity drainage. And it's not dissimilar to what I talked about earlier with steam injection in California, basically the same process, where they burn natural gas in a boiler plant up on the surface. They inject that steam. The steam does two things. One, it warms up the formation, that tar oil becomes less viscous, and it flows, gravity drains, to a collection well, a horizontal collection well. It's then pumped to the surface and processed through the Suncor-type facilities and then on down to Denver. So that steam-assisted gravity drainage basically is using steam to add pressure. It's using the heat in steam to improve the viscosity that allows this steam-assisted gravity drainage production to produce tar sands oil. The application of the geothermic fuel cell in Canada, where we also received patent protection, is to use the geothermic fuel cell as an in-situ steam generator. There is a native moisture content in this tar sands. By dropping geothermic fuel cells into the formation, running them on natural gas, it'll actually produce steam in-situ. That waste heat that we talked about earlier for oil shale production will improve the viscosity of the tar sands. And so you've got the same benefit of steam being produced on the surface for pressurizing the formation and warming it with a geothermic fuel cell. But the difference being is they burn natural gas to produce steam. We burn natural gas to run the GFC. We use the waste heat that was provided by the steam, but we're also producing massive amounts of electrical energy that would otherwise not be there.
Mm-hmm.
So we use fuel once, and we get those multiple benefits. And so the economics favor.
Sure.
The Canadian application. We have some similar interest in China.
There's
actually
my next question.
We've kind of been careful about China just because of the intellectual property concerns, reverse engineering and the like. Recently, I was contacted by a large investment fund in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, that own some big oil shale interests in Morocco that would like to partner and use our geothermic fuel cell to produce that resource.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I think one of the more interesting, and the answer gets a little more technical to be thorough with, but a really big and exciting opportunity is in Israel. Israel has a lot of oil shale. They are in serious need of more electrical energy. They're in serious need of more fresh water, and they've got a lot of natural gas. So with the oil shale to be produced, the ability to use the electrical output for a variety of things, including desalinization to produce fresh water, and use their natural gas in conjunction with our geothermic fuel cell. That's a pretty interesting opportunity, and there's some really, really smart people in Israel that have put together some really interesting applications and development scenarios that in the not-too-distant future we'll have the time to pursue.
Yeah, what I like about this story, too, is that usually, or many times with a sort of startup or emerging technology, you're out there saying, no, it solves this problem, sounds like it's the opposite, like, okay, when are you ready?
Yeah.
When are you delivering our first GFC?
Yeah, so the demand, the interest level is definitely there.
Yeah.
And that, again, that was why I'm pretty excited, and I know I've mentioned it a couple of times, not intending to plug Delphi Corporation, but they add a dimension to our commercialization capability that is pretty special.
So taking a look at the Rocky Mountain region, I mean, New Mexico, Colorado, Wyoming, such big oil and gas states, are the administrations in these states, the governors of these states, aware of this technology, and have you opened the door to conversation with them? It seems like they would be just as excited as Israel and Saudi Arabia. And
I would say yes, although the discussions have been pretty preliminary up until just recently. But I can tell you, I did have the opportunity to speak at length with Gary Herbert, who's the governor of Utah. And he was
Utah,
absolutely...
Sorry, Utah.
What's that?
I left Utah out of my Rocky Mountain region.
Yeah. He was absolutely kind of on the edge of his chair, excited with the opportunity to use this new technology to develop more of the hydrocarbon resources in Utah. So I think based on that more in-depth opportunity with Governor Herbert and some earlier opportunities in Washington, D.C., where I had a chance to speak with several different senators and other congressional leaders, I'm pretty confident about support.
Yeah, that's. What I was thinking more on the terms of educating. Once you have those administrations on board, then it's educating from the top down as far as your regulators go, and saying, you know, this uses less water, less emissions, and my other question then is, there are other applications for this technology with the heating of the ground. Can you talk about some more future applications of the technology?
Yeah, one of them. That was pretty interesting, and there's some folks really excited about it. And I'll use Africa as the case study. There's a delegation that's been contacting me fairly frequently over the last couple of years with the interest in using the geothermic fuel cell to produce fresh water. And
wow.
People don't realize this opportunity actually initially was presented to us from Canada. There are areas of Canada that are more or less arid, but are on top of existing large aquifers. But the groundwater is brackish. It's non-potable, so you couldn't produce it. It's not even good for crops because it has a lot of heavy minerals in it that would leave deposits on the surface and certainly would not be consumable. The idea is to use the high operating temperature of the geothermic fuel cell in an aquifer environment that will actually flash that water from the aquifer to steam. It's brought to the surface, condenses, and you basically have fresh water being condensed from that steam out of the aquifer. And so there are areas of Africa that everybody recognizes are very arid, but also have those same aquifer opportunities in areas where there's a lot of natural gas, no water, and because of their remoteness, no infrastructure for electrical power. So the electrification of these rural areas, big initiative in most developing third worlds to figure out how to get this distributed, or they call, some of them refer to it as village power. opportunities out in these remote locations where they can have electricity and have the benefit of that energy source. Well, this group from Africa is really keen on basically using the geothermic fuel cell in some of these remote arid locations to not only produce fresh water, but also locally, the power output from the GFC would be that village power remote electrification that they need. So that's one application. Another one that's on our radar screen, and it's covered under our patents, is to use the geothermic fuel cell for hazmat remediation, hazardous materials. So as you have these Superfund sites and other areas that in the 30s, 40s, 50s had all kinds of nasty stuff buried, infectious wastes and viral and bacteria stuff from hospitals and the like, there are applications utilizing the high heat, which would neutralize those viral and bacteria kinds of problems in some of these landfill locations. So hazmat remediation is another application.
Interesting. I wouldn't have even thought of those. That's crazy.
Me either. And I know, is there applications, as you talk about the Superfund sites, with all of those other kind of sites that use trash or waste as methane fuels and things like that? Is that an opportunity to look at as well?
It is. And one of the two unique benefits of solid oxide fuel cells, aside from that high operating temperature, is that they are capable of operating on multiple fuels. So things like the methane that comes from landfill refuge recovery makes a perfect fuel for a geothermic fuel cell. So that becomes kind of a free fuel, with the output being a combination of, to some extent, hazmat remediation, but also the production of electricity.
We've mentioned Delphi several times about manufacturing and how you're going to step up manufacturing to meet this apparent huge demand that you have, which is very exciting. How do you envision that commercialization rolling out?
Well, we, from a corporate strategy standpoint, have purposely kept our organization small and pretty nimble with working through partners, strategic partners, and investor groups. I think as we move into this 2015-2016 time frame, the size of this opportunity really lends itself to large organizations on the manufacturing side. We've mentioned Delphi earlier. But on the deployment side, companies like Shell, Total, France's Total Petroleum. So we have an existing agreement with Total, who is not only a technology, but a funding partner as well. And our rollout strategy involves a significant portion of the likely ownership, but certainly the management and operating expertise coming from these large multinational organizations. It'll be interesting to see at the end of the day if it's a combination or it's exclusive with an organization like Total or Shell.
As you've talked about this rollout strategy too, and you talked about it being primarily here in Colorado to really go forward because you've built these partnership agreements, I want to ask about the partnership agreements. You're a smallish, I'm not going to say small, but you're a smallish technology company in this energy sector. And it sounds like this partnership agreement kind of setup is really the way to go in this sector and in this field. Can you talk about the importance of Adelphi participating in Total and Shell and School of Mines and all of these folks in the success and the actual ramp up of the technologies?
Yeah, I think it sort of harkens back to several years ago when people trying to be competitive in a competitive economy, both locally and globally, talk about outsourcing. To me, because of the complexity of the oil and gas business and this opportunity in particular, the technology, the unbelievable expertise that the Department of Energy and Pacific Northwest National Labs in particular have brought, the idea of trying to develop, finance, manage an organization where you had all of that expertise in-house. I mean, I moved away from that business model 10, 15 years ago and have been pretty successful being a a small company that looked a lot bigger because of those kinds of partnerships. And so I think, you know, our business plan at Independent Energy Partners with respect to the geothermic fuel cell changed early on. We had actually planned on hiring the scientists and conducting the work that we ultimately hired the Department of Energy to do. Fortunately, saw the error in our ways early on and took that path. And so as a result, we have, you know, really A-team type players in all aspects of the work that we're doing, whether it's at the national lab, R&D level. Total is at the forefront, huge investments in the unconventional hydrocarbon space. A lot of it going on here in Colorado that a lot of folks aren't aware of. But yeah. I mean, there's large amounts of money, high levels of effort underway in addition to what Shell's doing that's being sponsored by Total right here in Colorado, some in Wyoming and Utah as well.
Yeah, I like that part of the story is that it really highlights we do have amazing national laboratories with unbelievably smart people in them, and then the ability of DOE to help coordinate all of that and insert their expertise as well. I think it's so important now that to sort of expedite the path for these technologies to get out there. So I agree that these partnerships are definitely the way to go.
Absolutely, and to get them through.
Yeah.
It just seems like we've talked about the regulatory, we've talked about the environmental, and you just think about the regulatory entities and the environmental entities and the kind of horsepower and financial horsepower you would have to get through them as a small organization without a partnership with some of these very large, you know, world-renowned organizations, as you spoke about with Total and Delphi and those folks, the labs. I mean, it would be very tough to do some of this stuff. So I think that speaks to the importance of building partnerships and working collaboratively instead of seeing it as a competitive way to work with each other.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And with respect to the regulatory issues and all the attention that will take early on in permitting and then generally just with regard to educating legislators and regulators, we have relationships with other local companies of world repute like CH2M Hill, who are very, very good at dealing with the local state and federal folks in the regulatory arena. So we'll be using those folks as well as part of another partnering arrangement as we move into those areas.
So, Alan, we have a few minutes left. What can we expect from Independent Energy Partners in the short to intermediate term?
Well, I think the things that will be in the news over the next 12 to 18 months are a series of milestones involved with the successful testing, both at Delphi and Colorado School of Mines, of the prototypes as we get ready to go to the field and actually make some oil. So I think over this next year to year and a half, we'll be moving, putting a lot of resources into that aspect of the program. And at the same time, going back to probably PNNL, Pacific Northwest National Labs, to take a look at some of these other applications I mentioned, where there'll need to be some refinements to the solid oxide fuel cell components to the geothermic fuel cell for things like tar sands, another big opportunity that we didn't touch on, but it's one of the other big ones for the United States, is in-situ coal gasification, coal-to-liquids arena. Huge opportunity.
Sure.
We have several hundred years' worth of coal deposits here in the United States, and on the one hand, you've got EPA and a lot of folks trying to minimize the use of that coal in power plants, but there are technologies dramatically and favorably impacted with the geothermic fuel cell that will take that coal, gasify it, and then through a process, the technical term is Fischer-Tropsch, is to take that gasified coal and actually convert it to high-quality fuel, diesel, and gasoline.
Well, Al, there's so much on the horizon. We're looking forward to hearing so much more about Independent Energy Partners. Thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it.
Have a wonderful weekend and join us next week.
You've been listening to Driving Force Radio with ICOSA, hosted by Jan Mazzotti. ICOSA invites you to do something different. Be a driving force. Influence change. Be a leader. Visit us at theicosamagazine.com.